note once again, this is year 12 of our Tuesday afternoon classes, believe it or not. I still remember that the old dark library before Shaare Shamayim's renovation. So we've come a long way. Now we're online. Isn't that wonderful?
We don't know for how long.
No, we don't. This is true. Whatever it'll be, it'll be. But for anyone who did not yet register and would like to, you can email Rebecca at mikorot18,
M-E-K-O-R-O-T-18. So just a second.
Okay, so I'll tell you what, Ruchama.
It's okay, because you respond the email where you got this link. Yes.
Okay. I just put the email in the chat for anyone who wants to sign up. That works. There is a fee for the year, but you know, arrangements can be made if it's a hardship. Please don't let that stop you from coming to learn. A couple of notes, because not everybody here has been in one of our series before, so I want to make sure to mention to you. I record audio of the classes, and I post it afterwards on YU Torah. And I will probably send out the link for it from today's class, just that you get a sense of how it works. And that way, if you miss a class, you're always able to download it, or if you just want to hear the greatest hits all over again. I do hope that people will feel comfortable keeping their video on. I'm not recording video of the class. It's certainly much better for me. I always prefer to see people when I'm speaking. So I would appreciate it. Also, if you have comments, questions during the class, please do not write them in the chat. Instead, you know, say it outright. Ask the question. Interrupt is just fine. This is meant to be a conversation, and that to me works a lot better. So that way, I don't have to worry about monitoring the chat while also giving the class. Other things? I think those are the introductions. I will note that the series as a whole across the year is dedicated by Dana and Ilan Rubinstein, and that this specific session actually has a few people who dedicated the class, David and Chana Klein, Maury and Carrie Clients, and Maury Korenblit, and also it's dedicated in memory of Yisrael ben Avram Weinstock, Olav HaShalom, whose yahrzeit is on the 8th of Cheshvan, which is next week. Dedicated by his family. Shama should have an aliyah. Okay, so we're doing Megillat Esther. So there's a lot to talk about here. But the first question that I want to begin our discussion with is, why learn the book of Esther at all? What's the point of learning Megillat Esther? We're familiar with the story. You hear about it Purim time. You learn about it as a kid. Why would one want to spend time learning Megillat Esther?
So I'll just suggest that it's a very strange book to be in the canon. It's a very strange story, which would not seem that may or may not include God. And it also doesn't seem to be the kind of lifestyle that one thinks that one wants to emulate, or all kinds of other things. So what's it doing here?
Yes, what is this doing in Tanakh anyway? This is a legitimate question for sure, and grounds for learning the book for sure. Gita, you were going to say? No? Okay, I misunderstood. I want to show you a source, which is often discussed, somewhat misunderstood, and it's the first source on the source sheet. Everyone got the source sheet either from me or from Rebecca? If not, I'm going to post it here in the chat as well so that people will be able to download it. Okay, so I just put the PDF in the chat, so you should be able to download that as well and use it. But the source is the first source you see there. It's from the Jerusalem Talmud Yerushalmi. Classic line quoted in a variety of contexts. Rabbi Yochanan Amar, Rabbi Yochanan said, "Hanivim v'ketuvim atidin libatel." He says, the prophets and the writings, the latter two-thirds of Tanakh, will be canceled. They're going to disappear at some point. V'chameshet sifrei Torah einan atidin libatel, but not Chumash. He says, Chumash will always be there. Matama, what's your basis for saying that Chumash will never disappear? Because at Har Sinai, Hashem spoke, Kol Gadol Velo Yasaf. It was a great voice, and the way he translates Lo Yasaf is, it did not cease. The voice at Sinai never halted. Now, clearly this is homiletic, meaning the voice at Sinai is not the voice that is speaking all five books, right? As the Gemara discusses, we receive sections of the Chumash later on when we are in the wilderness. Not to mention, this doesn't say anything about the prophets and the writings ceasing. It just says that the voice at Sinai never stops. Nonetheless, bear with Rabbi Yochanan, because Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish is the one we're really interested in. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish Amar, Af Megillat Esther v'alachot einan atidin libatel. He says, not only does the Chumash never cease, but also the book of Esther and Halachot, meaning Mishnah, those also will never cease. Why? Biblical verses. You have the line of Kol Gadol V'lo Yasaf at Sinai, that voice that did not cease. Well, in Esther we're told, V'zichram lo yasuf mizar'am, that the story of Esther, the memory of the days of Purim, will never cease from their descendants. We're never going to forget Purim. Therefore, the book of Esther cannot possibly stop. Whatever's going to happen to the rest of Tanakh, the book of Esther remains, as does Mishnah, based on a verse in Chavakuk. But I'm not going into the Mishnah discussion. The point is, Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, says the book of Esther is eternal. That line from the Jerusalem Talmud is brought into the Rambam. If you take a look at source number 2, at the end of the Laws of Purim, the Rambam brings you the following statement. In the interests of time, I am going to just read my English translation, but you can see I gave you the original Hebrew on the sheet as well. All the books of the prophets and all the writings will be annulled in the days of Mashiach. The only exception, he says, is the book of Esther, which will stand like the five Chumashim, like the laws of the spoken Torah, by which he's referring to the Mishnah there, which are never annulled. He's quoting you the passage from the Jerusalem Talmud, changing the wording slightly. And then he says, although the memory of the troubles will be annulled, as it is written, for all the first troubles have been forgotten, have been hidden from my eyes, the days of Purim will not be annulled. As it is written, these days of Purim will not pass from among the Jews, v'zichram lo yasuf mizar'am, their memory will not cease from among their descendants. Purim will remain, the book of Esther will remain. That book will never disappear. What does that mean when we're told the book will never disappear and will still persist even in the time of Mashiach? What's the message that the Rambam, based on the Jerusalem Talmud, is trying to convey to us? What's he saying?
I think that the lessons that we have to learn from the Megillah, like that there's something that we still need to learn, even in days of Mashiach. Because,
good.
I mean, as to what Rebecca was saying before, there are a lot of parts of the Chumash that you can kind of just look at without a deeper meaning and say, wow, that's not something I want to emulate. But there's a lesson to be learned that I think will continue in days of Mashiach.
Right. I'm going to come back to Rebecca's point later on because there's much to be said.
Is there a connection between the question you're asking and the sentence we say in
Havdalah? What do you mean? Lai
Hudin,
Mai Ta'orah, V'simcha, that one?
Yeah.
In what way? Right. So good. The idea then that there is something to take from the Megillah that has application in our lives. But keep in mind what the Rambam is saying. He's saying even in the time of Mashiach, it's going to persist. At a time when we would hope the need for light and the need for joy is not as dire as it is today. The truth is that the idea that Jeanette expressed, and that I think Joyce is leaning towards also, is sort of where I want to go. But I had other sources that I wanted to show you first before I get there. So, if you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 3, you find the Ravid. The Ravid, Rabbi Avram ibn Daud, writes a commentary on Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, his work of law, in which, basically, anytime he doesn't like something the Rambam said, he's going to let you know. So take a look at source number 3, where he tells you, he quotes you the Rambam, who says that all these other books are going to be null and void. And he says, Devar Hedyotos Huzeh. He says, yeah, that's something that a plain person would say. I was being charitable by translating Hedyotos as a plain person. Often Hedyot means a fool. It can mean either way. But if it's the Ravid speaking, knowing his speech tendencies, he's saying, yeah, that's a foolish thing for you to say. What do you mean? He says, Lo yibatel sefer mikol asfarim. He says, no book in Tanakh is going away. That's nonsense. Ain't sefer shein bo limud. Every book has something to teach. So then what was the point? The point is public reading of these books. And the idea is, people may stop learning Yeshaya, which I don't think they ever should. But people may stop learning Yeshaya. People may stop learning Yechezkel. But they're never going to stop learning of Esther. These books will always be read communally. And that's one approach to the problem. Another approach to it, similar approach, is found in the writing of Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, the Pachad Yitzchak. He says, Esther is eternally relevant, and it's relevant in the time of Mashiach because it predicts Mashiach. There is so much in the book of Esther that is messianically oriented. For example, when Esther says, let the king and Haman come to my feast tomorrow, machar, it's a reference to an ultimate machar, an ultimate tomorrow, a messianic time. So therefore, the content will remain relevant. Another approach, kind of the opposite approach, the Radomska Rebbe, the Tiferet Shlomo, says just the opposite. Other stories are overshadowed by Mashiach, but Purim is not. He says, don't worry about all these different answers. This isn't going to be on the final. I'm just trying to show a little bit of the breadth of approaches that are found to this line. The Radomska Rebbe says other celebrations are about God's chesed, God's kindness, which we didn't deserve. However, on Purim, we actually did deserve it. When you read the book of Esther, you find that we earned our redemption. There's a national repentance. There are acts of greatness by Esther and Mordechai. And therefore, we earned it. Hang on, Ruchama, hold on one second. What I'm trying to show is that you have a range of ideas here about the relevance of Esther, in which Ravid says all books are going to continue to be read, but this is going to have a communal reading. You have the idea that Esther is relevant in the time of Mashiach because it relates to Mashiach. It's a Mashiach-like event. And then you have the argument that actually Mashiach is about God's kindness. Esther is a separate concept. It's about us earning it. And therefore it remains relevant. Mashiach doesn't do away with it. All sorts of different ideas for why this book remains relevant and is read. But to me, and then I'm going to come back to you, Ruchama, to me, the fundamental point that we should look at is that the book of Esther remains relevant for us because of the lessons that it has to teach, and one more very important point, because of our relationship with the story. Take a look at source number 4, please, towards the end of the book of Esther. This is the passage that we were quoting about the memory of these days never leaving the Jews. Look at the passage.
The Jews upheld and accepted upon themselves and their descendants and all who would join them. All of them. No exceptions. Lihiot osim et shnei hayamim ha'ele, to practice these 2 days, Purim and Shushan Purim, kichtavam v'chizmanam, as they are written at their times, b'chol shana v'shana, every single year, v'hayamim ha'ele nizkarim v'naasim b'chol dor v'dor, and they are going to be practiced in every generation, every family, every land, every city. These days will never leave the Jews. Their memory will not cease from among their descendants. And what I draw from that line is more than just that there are lessons to be drawn from the book, although that's true, but it speaks to an emotional connection. The Jews got up and accepted upon themselves. not a decree. It's acceptance. We chose. We said, we are going to practice this. Our descendants are going to practice this without exception in every generation, in every family, in every nation, in every city. There's an emotional bond between the Jew and the Purim story. And that's really what we're talking about when we say, Zichram lo yasuf mizaram, that it's never going to cease. Yes, there are elements of eternal relevance, even in the time of Mashiach, especially in the time of Mashiach, perhaps. There are lessons to be drawn from it, as Jeanette pointed out. There is the need for joy in our dark times, for sure, as Joyce pointed out. But fundamentally, we love the story. We have an attachment to it. Ruchama, what were you going to say? So Ruchama asks an excellent question. Where's the happy ending? Right? Where's the happy ending? This isn't the only book like that. Right? Consider the end of Sefer Bereishit. Right? After the whole saga of the family of Yaakov and Rachel and Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah and the split among the brothers and Yosef being sold, right? Suffering in Egypt and all of that. And Yaakov being miserable thinking that his son is dead. And then finally we get the reunion at the end, the happy ending, in order for the Jews to become slaves in Egypt for centuries. Where's the happy ending? That's not a happy ending.
That is a sad one, so to speak. Ashiteinu Hashem Elecha, it's finished, and there is a hope, and here's the true mass. So what's the Ruchama? Who said we have to have a happy ending? I mean, possibly the good news is they weren't killed. But maybe the lesson is that we are still in that cycle. I mean, we just go back to serving that foreign king and not moving from Paras and Madai. I mean, it's a familiar story. It goes
right
through the centuries.
So I'm going to come back to this point.
Back.
I'm going to come back to this point that Ruchama is making. It's going to matter a great deal. I'm just not quite there yet. But you're right. You don't have a happy ending in this book. The tax may actually be a happy ending. We'll have to talk about that when we get to chapter 10. There's a story behind that tax. It's not just random. But this brings me to our goals for learning the book of Esther. After 2 years of doing Yeshaya, and then before that, 2 years of Ezra and Nehemiah, and then I think before that, 2 years of Eov, of Job. I wanted to do something which would be more familiar to people, where you walk in with some level of familiarity with it, something with less poetry and more narrative to it, something that's a little less dark in its tone, granted that, you know, death sentence on the nation qualifies as dark. You know, understood. Nonetheless, not as dark as chapter after chapter of Yeshaya warning that the Assyrians are coming, and after them, the Babylonians. And most of all, because we love the story. But there are challenges in learning Esther. First of all, how can you offer something new on a book many of us have been hearing since grade school? You know, it's hard to say something new and to have a different perspective. Also, this class, the Tuesday afternoon class that we've been doing, has always been a text-based class. Parenthetically, I will note, people should please have a Tanakh with them. Any edition is fine. Should have English, if you like English, or Spanish, or any other edition that you like, but please have a Tanakh with you, because I would like to avoid having to also bring Tanakh and translate it on the source sheets. There's enough already to put on there. So for this week, I did. I brought the verses and did the translations, but normally, I'm going to want to be able to refer to the book without putting the book on the sheet. So please have a Tanakh with you. But going back to my main point, we want the class to be text-based, but we don't have the time to do 10 chapters line by line. Otherwise, this will be like Yeshaya all over again, in which we'll end up doing this for 2 years. So this is what I have as a plan. For today, I want to introduce the period of the book of Esther.
having done that, giving history, background, context, I want to go through the book looking at the key events and the key themes on multiple levels. And we're going to be using an array of sources. We'll be looking at, obviously, say, you know, Megillat Esther itself, as well as parallel passages in Tanakh. We will be looking at some of the Midrashim on the Book of Esther in depth. We'll be looking at commentators, particularly those which like to pay close attention to text, like the Malbim. Some of the philosophical commentators from time to time, like the Maharal. And the Dat Mikra edition, edited by Professor Amos Chacham, will always be very useful. But what I want to get out of this, at the end of the day, what I'm looking for after our study of Esther is an understanding of what are the timeless story elements and messages that have so seized our national attention and our national affection. What is it that makes us love Megillat Esther? Now, for some people, they love Esther not because of Esther at all. Some people just love it because they have memories of, as a kid, getting to dress up and go to shul, and you get shalach manos and all those other things, and hey, that's fine. Nonetheless, what is it about the book itself that so seizes our affections? I'm going to send out an email later today, I expect, to the list of whoever has registered, just calling for feedback on format, content, what you're looking for in the book. So I'm going to be looking for that from you. Okay, so let's start. Let's start, I think, with history. And in order to discuss the history of the book, we need to meet the Persians. So I say the Persians first because they're introduced first in the book, right? When do we first meet the Jews in the Book of Esther? No, when do we meet the Jews in Esther? Right, second chapter. We're looking for a queen. The first chapter does not seem to have Jews involved. We'll find out that we get read into the story. Don't worry. But fundamentally, we're in the second chapter. So the first chapter is indeed time to meet the Persians. So this story takes place during what is called the Achaemenid dynasty. This was the first great Persian empire. It was founded by Cyrus the Great. Working with secular chronology for reasons I'll come back to, Cyrus founds this empire somewhere around the year 550 before the Common Era. At the time, it's a collection of sort of semi-nomadic tribes who raise sheep and goats and cattle in what is today Iran. It would go on to become, like the Book of Esther says, one of the largest empires in history, stretched all the way from the Balkan Peninsula in the west to India in the east. Darius the Great, who is the fourth king of the Achaemenid Empire, or depends on how you count the kings, I suppose, could be the third, ruled over the Persian Empire at its largest, stretching from the Caucasus and West Asia to what was then Macedonia, and today, as I mentioned, is the Balkans. It included the Black Sea, Central Asia, parts of Libya, and Egypt, in Africa. Really a monster-sized empire. I gave you in source number 5 on the sheet a list of Persian kings from this period of time. I'm just going to mute people because I'm getting a little bit of background noise, but you can always unmute to ask a question or make a comment. The list of kings here, and again, I'm working with the secular chronology, and here I'll explain why. Those who were with us when we learned Daniel will remember this. There's a gap of about 160 years between the traditional chronology recorded in a Midrashic book called Seder Olam and the years that the historians give us for the Persian Empire. Normally, you can sort of deal with that by saying, so here is the secular year and here is the year that Seder Olam gives. But you can't do that when you're dealing with the Persian kings because Seder Olam doesn't know that these Persian kings exist or doesn't acknowledge that they exist. In Seder Olam's version of history, there were only about 4 Persian kings in this entire period. And the period is a lot shorter. It's missing a lot of years. Why that is? Great discussion, which we sort of discussed somewhat when we did Daniel. It's not really our topic for right now. There are different theories that are proposed, but the bottom line is that you can't really give Seder Olam years because there aren't any for these kings. Some of these kings, like I said, are not even listed. So I listed Cambyses the First, even though he's not really part of the dynasty, just because otherwise you start Cambyses with the Second, and everyone's like, well, where's the First? So the answer is the First was there. He's Cyrus's father. Cyrus, we said, was the founder of the dynasty. He conquered Babel, Babylon, in the year 539. We learned about that in the book of Ezra. He was the one who sent the Jews back to ultimately build the Beit HaMikdash. Cambyses II is the son of Cyrus, followed by Darius I. Cyrus, I gave you in parentheses there, Cyrus is the one who in Tanakh we call Koresh. Darius we call Daryavesh. Then Xerxes. I'm going to come back to Xerxes being Ahasuerus in a little bit. Then you've got Artaxerxes, or Artaxasta, as he's called in the book of Ezra. And then you've got Darius II, also known as Daryavesh, and it goes on. I didn't list you more Artaxerxeses, because I feel like one Artaxerxes is really enough. But ultimately, in the year 330 before the Common Era, Alexander the Great invades and takes down the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was known for culture. It was known for trade. And in the Persian Empire, you ultimately get a religion known as Zoroastrianism, this dualistic religion that believes in forces of light and forces of darkness, forces of good and forces of evil, however you want to frame that. That becomes part of an essential part of the Persian Empire. They're also known for certain traits that are going to come up in the Megillah. Take a look at source number 6 from Herodotus. A note about Herodotus. Anybody familiar with Herodotus? I keep saying his name because I'm really proud of myself for learning how to pronounce it. Herodotus, Herodotus, Herodotus. I keep on saying it. So what you have to know about Herodotus is that he's Greek. You know the line, history is written by the victor? So he gives you the record of the Persian Empire. So you have to know that some people consider him the father of history, and other people consider him the father of lies. Because he wasn't really biased in favor of the Persians. So take what he says about the Persians with a grain of salt. He's a little bit of a polemicizer. Take a look at source number 6, though, because this will ring, ring true for those who know the book of Esther. He says of the Persians, they are very partial to wine. No one may vomit or urinate in another's presence. This is prohibited among them. Good trait. Moreover, it is their custom to deliberate about the gravest matters when they are drunk. And what they approve in their deliberations is proposed to them the next day when they are sober by the master of the house where they deliberate. And if, being sober, they still approve it, they act on it. But if not, they drop it. And if they have deliberated about a matter when sober, they decide upon it when they are drunk. So in other words, every decision requires a little element of intoxication. That's really what the what Herodotus is saying about the Persians. So whether he's accurate or not, this will ring true from the Book of Esther, and something that we're going to come back to, the role of wine in the Book of Esther. And then one other line in source number 7, a little bit further along in his description of the Persians, he says, every Persian marries many lawful wives and keeps still more concubines. That was how the Greeks looked at the Persians, and also something that obviously from chapter 2, rings in terms of Ahasuerus and his multiple wives. So he's saying it's not just the king who does this. This is actually a national pastime. All right. So that's a little bit about Persians. We're going to have to learn a lot more about them, I think, in the course of the book. Let's talk about Ahasuerus, who I have already told you may well be the king labeled Xerxes. Take a look at source number 8, please, from the book of Ezra. This is a passage which may give nightmares to those who were with us when we did Ezra. I see quite a few of you who were there at the time when we did the beginning of Ezra. This would be 4 years ago already. I see even a smile or two from those who were there. But chapter 4 was a challenge. If you remember the way the book of Ezra works, the Jews come back to the land of Israel in chapter 1, chapter 2. Cyrus sends them back. Chapter 2 is this big lineage chapter. Chapter 3, they build an altar. They start on construction of the Beit HaMikdash, of the temple. Parenthetically, Ezra's not there yet. Ezra doesn't show up until chapter 7. But in chapter 4, we learn that the locals are giving us a hard time. The Samaritans are not happy about the Jews building this Beit HaMikdash, this temple, and they try to get the Persians to shut us down. And that's what's brought in chapter 4. The problem of chapter 4 is that it jumps around a little bit in history, and it's not clear which events are happening when. So take a look at source number 8. This is from that chapter. And again, I'm just going to read out my English translation, but those who want to see the Hebrew, I give it to you on the sheet as well. And the nation of the land, those are the Samaritans, weakened the hands of Yehuda, of Judea, frightening them in their construction, and hiring advisors against them to ruin their counsel all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, at the start of his reign, they wrote an attack against the dwellers of Judea and Jerusalem. So what you see there is a king by the name of Ahasuerus. Is that necessarily the Ahasuerus of Purim? Unclear. Rashi thinks it is. Rashi believes that this is actually Ahasuerus, king of Persia, and that he's between Cyrus and Darius. So if you go back to source number 5, where I gave you the list of kings, Rashi seems to believe that Ahasuerus is Cambyses II. That seems to be Rashi's take. Ibn Ezra says, no, that's not who this Ahasuerus is. This Ahasuerus is Artaxasta, which becomes very confusing because we list them separately. Nonetheless, the historians tend to say that this Ahasuerus is indeed Xerxes. Specifically the Xerxes who follows Darius the First. That's who we are talking about at this point. How we know that this should be that Xerxes? Just looking at my sheet, trying to figure out when I want to do this. I'm going to come back. I'm not quite going to make the argument yet. Right now, I'll just tell you that the argument of historians tends to be that it in fact is the Xerxes who follows Darius the First, who may or may not be the Purim Ahasuerus. But this is one reference to Ahasuerus in Tanakh, in Ezra. Maybe the Purim one, may not be. Yes, Janine.
So according to that, Koresh's decree came before Megillah, the time before.
Everybody has to agree that Cyrus is before the Purim story, and the Jews have already been freed to return to Israel. And not just freed to return, but have been sent back. That has to be accepted. The simple reason for that is because before Cyrus, the Persians are a nothing. There's no empire of 127 lands. So it has to be after Cyrus. That is going to create certain problems for us later on, but we're not there yet. But yes, it's post-Cyrus. But that's one reference. Yeah, Susan.
Do we consider Megillah Esther as old? But I know a lot of books in the Arts House that are historical, but this one seems to be more historical. Like, we consider it's giving the history. It's not just the story, but it's also
a historical
piece of work.
Yes. It is definitely considered a work of history, such that I would be negatively surprised if there was something here that didn't, you know, fit with history. I would not simply be able to write it off as metaphorical or something like that. We expect this to comport with history. That's correct. So that's one use of Ahasuerus. The other mention of Ahasuerus in Tanakh is found in source number 9 in the book of Daniel, where we mention Darius, king of Mede, of Madai, of Media, who was the son of Ahasuerus. Now, who Darius the Mede is really its own historical problem that we did discuss when we learned Daniel. I'm not going back to that. But now what we've seen is the entire collection of Ahasuerus' appearances in Tanakh. You've got a reference in the book of Ezra, who may be the one of Purim, who may not be. You have a reference in Daniel, who may be the one of Purim, who may not be. So can we figure out who this Ahasuerus of Purim actually is in the list of kings? And the answer is yes. We can rule out some of the kings easily. Go back to source number 5. We know it's not Cyrus. Cyrus is Koresh. We know it's not Darius. Not Darius 1, not Darius 2. Because we know Darius as Daryavesh. That's how he's named in Tanakh. Can't really be Artaxerxes because he's listed in Ezra as Artaxasta. And granted, even Ezra wants to make Artaxasta Ahasuerus, that's an unpopular position. So we can rule out some of these. Cambyses II was, as we noted, Rashi's favorite to be Ahasuerus. And there are midrashim that fit. So for example, when we talk about Ahasuerus saying to Esther, "What do you want? I'll give you up to half of my kingdom." And the Medrash says on that he's saying, up to the construction of the temple, the Beit HaMikdash, that I won't give you. So that means it hasn't yet been built. That fits if it's Cambyses II. So in that sense, it would work. We also have a Midrash that says that Ahasuerus and Esther have a son whose name is Darius, and that he is the one who enables them to build the Beit HaMikdash, to build the temple. So if it's Cambyses II, that works really nicely. It also fits what we know about Cambyses II. He was expansionist and insecure. Don't tell him I said that. He was also brutal. But that's how he's known. Herodotus certainly records that. So you could say that. However, the name Cambyses does not really translate to Ahasuerus, just from a name perspective, like Cyrus, Koresh, I can do that, right? Daryavesh, Darius, that works. Cambyses Ahasuerus is a lot harder to do. So that's a weakness. The main approach is, as I said before, that it is Xerxes. First of all, because the name works. Take a look now on your sheet, please. Professor Gavriel Cohn wrote the introduction to the Dot Mikra on Esther, and he made this point. But if I had brought it from him, I would have had to do two things. Number one, I would have had to retype, because you can't cut and paste the Dot Mikra. And number two, I would have had to translate it. But I found that Mitchell First actually wrote an article about this in source number 10, and so I didn't need to bring Gabriel Cohen and translate him, because Mitchell First did it. For those who aren't familiar with him, he's a very interesting fellow. He's a lawyer, lives in New Jersey, and has certain interests that he's very, very into. One of them is the history of the Persian period. He wrote a long and detailed book on the problem that I mentioned earlier about the missing 100-and-something years, trying to show all the different positions on it and the explanations for it. So he has an article here in which he talks about the Ahasuerus identification with Xerxes. Take a look. He says, "This identification of Ahasuerus with Xerxes was only determined once old Persian cuneiform was deciphered in the mid-19th century. Once the code was cracked, it was discovered that the name of the king that the Greeks had been referring to as Xerxes was in fact I'm not going to pronounce that one. Khshiarsha. The Greeks could not properly record his name because they didn't have a letter to represent the shin sound. Khshiarsha is very close to the Hebrew Ahasuerus, with the two names identical in their consonantal structure, centering on the consonantal sounds kh, sh, r, and sh. And the Hebrew only adding two vavs and an initial aleph. So Ahasuerus is Khshiarsha. Even scholars who do not believe in the historicity of the Megillah are typically willing to accept that when the Megillah refers to Ahasuerus, the intent is a reference to Xerxes Khshiarsha. You follow? In other words, even those who think that Megillat Esther is made up think that it is a story of historical fiction being made up about King Xerxes. That's the idea. It also makes sense to do that, That passage in Ezra that we quoted in source number 8 works better this way, with Ahasuerus being after Darius and before Artaxasta Artaxerxes. So that works well if that's the Purim, the Ahasuerus of Purim. Another advantage is in terms of what we know historically about Xerxes. You see, again, working from Herodotus, he says that Xerxes was named as king-in-waiting. His father Darius went to war against Egypt and Greece. And his father was killed, and that's how Xerxes became king. And he defeats Egypt and then needs to figure out what he's going to do with the Greeks. So in his third year, he holds a gathering of all of the Persian nobility to discuss next steps. So that actually fits really, really well. Then he goes into Greece and he gets defeated, but that's its own discussion. Also, Herodotus believes that Xerxes was heavily into cruelty, hungry for conquest, and heavily involved with women as well. So, points for that identification. Sorry? There are certain problems, though, with this identification. We know that Xerxes' wife was a woman named Amestris. So First actually argues that Amestris Esther works really well. Maybe. Another problem here is that if Ahasuerus is really this late in the Persian Empire, and Mordechai was one of the exiles taken originally from Israel to Babel, as seems to be recorded in chapter 2, he would have to have survived about 110 years to this point. Now, that's hardly the first time that somebody is superannuated in Tanakh. Nonetheless, it's a hard sell. You could say maybe he was descended from those exiles. You could make that argument. But that's something that is a bit of a concern with the Xerxes identification. We have more to talk about with it. I just wanted to give a flavor of some of the history and some of the orientation here to it before we get into the book itself. But the things to know about Persia are, again, just to summarize, they are expansionist. They are a rising cultural hub. They are a mega empire, a sprawling empire. And King Xerxes, who reigns at a time when they are at their height, is likely Ahasuerus. That's to sum up in a sentence what I've been trying to get across. The Medes, Madai, are a nation in northwestern Iran. The Persians actually conquered the Medes. Cyrus was the grandson of the last king of Media. Every time I say king of Media, there are people I think of, but nonetheless, he is the grandson of the last king of the Medes. But we don't have a whole lot of other information about them. But let's talk about the Jews. And this is going to take me back to a point that was made before by Ruchama about the happy ending. Who are the Jews at this point? What can you tell me about the Jews, not from the Book of Esther, but from what you know of the Jews at this point in our history? What do we know? Good. So what we do know, I'll get to you in 1 second, Hannah. What we do know at this stage is indeed that many, many Jews remain behind. Only 42,000 and change made the trip with Ezra. We also know that those Jews who remained behind were very skeptical about, I said with Ezra, I don't mean with Ezra, it's before Ezra, but when Cyrus sent them back. Ezra has his own group that goes with him. But we know that the Jews who remained behind were skeptical
about the nature of this enterprise to build a Beit HaMikdash, to build a temple. If you remember the book of Zechariah, we did Zechariah 10 or 11 years ago. So Rebecca was there and Joyce was there. I'm not sure who else was there at the time. But what we learned in Zechariah was that there were Jews living in Bavel, which is then Persia, who sent a delegation to Zechariah asking him, should we fast on our fast days? Is this the redemption or isn't it the redemption? Nothing changes from that period until today. Jews still staying in exile, sending others to go back to the land, and questioning the messianic character of the rebuilding. So we find that as well. Chana, you were going to say? Right. So the Jews who returned tended to be impoverished, although supported by Cyrus. The Jews who stayed behind in exile were not necessarily doing a whole lot better. The ones who stayed behind in Babel were not necessarily doing a whole lot better. We know that they were ignorant of Torah in many respects. That emerges in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. There were all sorts of lineage problems among those Jews. We find when Ezra comes back, he tries to identify who the Kohanim were, and some of the Kohanim are missing the books that are supposed to record their lineage, and that's a problem. We find that the Jews who come back to Israel intermarry among the Canaanites, and it's not so clear whether that was a continuation of a practice that had already gone on back in Babylon. We know separately that Aramaic has become the language of the Jews who live in Babel / Persia. That really becomes their tongue. They speak Aramaic. Their knowledge of Hebrew is much weaker, which affects a whole variety of things. This is an exile population in trouble. That's really what we're looking at. They're in economic trouble. They're in religious trouble. And one wonders how long they would have retained their identity there if not for the events of Purim. And that brings me to a comment by Yoram Chazoni. He wrote a book called The Dawn. It's now probably, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago that he came out with the book, maybe a little less, maybe 10 to 15 years ago. It's a very interesting read. It's very readable. I enjoyed reading it. And he makes the comment that the Jews in exile and Jewish life in exile are the goal of the Book of Esther. In doing so, he answers a question that everybody should be asking, which is, if this book, as I said to Janine before, is taking place after the Jews have already been licensed by Cyrus to return, when they've already built a Mizbeach, they've built an altar, right, which we did months after we got back, if we're trying to build a Beit HaMikdash, a temple, where are we in the book of Esther? Why is there not a single mention in the entire book of the Jews who are living in Israel? They're just subsumed under the 127 lands? They have no independent significance? So take a look at what Chazoni says. He's not answering that question directly, but what he writes here does address the question. Source number 11. When the rabbis of the Talmud looked back across Jewish history, seeking to grant it coherence and permanence by assembling its teachings into a canon, they understood Esther to be of the utmost significance in concluding the Bible. He has the rabbis of the Talmud canonizing. That's actually its own discussion, which we're not going to do today. Maybe at some point we will. But we get to like chapters 8 and 9, and we talk about the question of who wrote the book of Esther. We'll need to really discuss that. But in any case, he says the goal in canonizing Esther was they understood it to be of the utmost significance in concluding the Bible. To begin unraveling the riddle of Esther's meaning, we must first recognize that Esther is a book about exile. That is, unlike most of the other writings in the Bible, which depict the Jews in their efforts to come to the land of Israel and build a Jewish nation there, Esther describes a world in which the Jews are distant from their land, their tradition, and their God. Think about it. Most of Tanakh
has no direct relationship with the life of a Jew in Canada. We learn all sorts of lessons. We learn our halachic obligations. But realistically, it's meant for Jews who live in Israel. That's what it's all about. But not the Book of Esther. The Book of Esther is about existence in exile. And I brought you just a brief excerpt. He goes on this at length. In exile, whether in ancient Persia or in a more contemporary one, Jewish life must somehow persist without the immense resources made available by independent sovereign power. In exile, the Jews must live in dispersion, their institutions weak, their concerns wandering far from Jewish things, and their politics alienated from every obvious source of cohesiveness, direction, and strength. He goes on quite at length with the Gita. You like that quote? That's the idea here, is this is a book about the exile experience. So to go back to what Ruchama said, she said, you know, the ending of this book is not a happy ending. You're right. Because we're still in exile. Or as the Gemara says it, Akati Avdei HaShverosh Anan. Right? The Gemara wants to know why we don't say Halel on Purim. And it has multiple answers. But one of the answers is because at the end of the day, we're still slaves of Achashverosh. We're still paying taxes. That's exactly the point. This is not a book with a happy ending. This is a book about exile. And survival is the goal. Yes, Susan.
When we say we were paying taxes, wasn't taxes common to any conquered people? I don't know. Well, at least I think we were singled out, as we may have been in many other bad things that happened. But from what I understand, that when you're conquered, that's one of the punishments of being conquered. It wasn't like you Jews are paying taxes.
No, that's true.
No one else is.
That's true. No, we're also not the only scattered nation. The word diaspora, believe it or not, is not a Jewish word. It's a Greek word. The idea is not to say we are unique in this regard, only that this is a book describing our exile experience. Right, no, but the Book of Esther is our book.
Yes.
And so it's going to describe things from our perspective. You know, but no, the book stresses that the tax is on everybody. And that's principal to the story. But again, we have to get to chapter 10 in order to really, really get where that is. So one other note in this history introduction, people like to discuss the historicity of the book. And did this really happen? And is there anything to be found in the Persian records about, you know, attesting to a Jewish queen and all of that? So I'm going to punt on this one by referring you in source number 12 to a book called Purim and the Persian Empire by Rabbi Yehuda Landi. Many, many years ago, I was in Camp Stechemet and he was there. This would be, I don't know, 34 years ago. I was gratified to see his name again as the author of this book, in which he basically works from the British Museum archives to try to demonstrate that there are historical sources and archaeological sources supporting the Purim story. And I leave it to you to read the book. Anything I would say would just come from what he said anyway. So that's something that those who want to research it certainly may. What are the themes of this book? Aside from the story, which is nice, but what are the themes of this book? What would you say, central messages of the Book of Esther? Drinking and governing can kill a friendship. The idea, Chana says, that God brings the cure before the disease or before the wound. I would expand further, although you're right, and say, in general, the theme of the divine hand orchestrating events invisibly but miraculously is something that the sages certainly perceive there. Rebecca noted in the beginning that we don't have God's name here. You didn't make that specific comment, but that, you know, in general, you don't find God discussed overtly, although it's a very religious book, meaning when the people find out that they're under threat, their reaction is, let's fast for 3 days. So don't kid yourself. It's a book in which the people are religious, even if the narrator isn't. But I want to just show you one text quickly, and then I saw you unmute, Rebecca, so I'll take what you wanted to say. But take a look at source number 15. I'm jumping just because Chana mentioned the issue of the divine hand. The last chapter of Masechet Brachot is, among other things, a great repository of information regarding dream interpretation. Mind you, much of it is spent telling you that dreams are meaningless and don't get hung up on them. They're just what you were thinking about during the day. It's indigestion and so on. Nonetheless, it also provides you with messages that you could read into dreams you have. And it talks in this passage in source number 15 about people who, while they are sleeping, see a book from Tanakh and what the message is of the book that they see. I know there were some people in the last 2 years who were having nightmares about Yeshaya, thanks to our Tuesday classes. But let's see what you have here. These are books from Ketuvim, from the writings. So in the interest of time, I'm going to just read my translation aloud, but you have the original there. There are three great writings, books from Ketuvim. If you see Tehillim, it's a message, piety is coming your way. If you dream about Tehillim, you're going to be pious. Proverbs, Mishle, anticipate wisdom. Job, if you're dreaming about Job, worry about suffering. That may be a message. And then you have three minor writings. Minor meaning they're shorter. Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, piety, the love relationship, and so forth. Ecclesiastes, wisdom. Echa, Lamentations, suffering. And then one who sees the book of Esther, a miracle has been done for him. The book of Esther represents miracles, the hand of God behind the scenes, but definitely present. That's one of the national themes of the book of Esther. Another national theme of the book of Esther is exile. As we've already said from Chazoni's point, it's very much about exile. Exile in terms of how you relate to the government, and exile in terms of how you relate to God. I brought you a passage in source number 13. This is the passage, the classic passage about what Esther ate in the palace, when the text says that the agent in charge of the harem gave her something different. He altered her and her maids. What does that mean? So Rav says it means that he gave her Jewish food. You know, deli, cha, you know, that kind of thing. He gave her Jewish food. Basically all the things with a lot of calories and fat and triglycerides. Shmuel said he fed her the necks of pigs. And Rabbi Yochanan links it to Daniel. We're going to have to come back to that. What are Rav and Shmuel both saying to you here? What is the message of Rav and Shmuel?
They were aware she was Jewish.
Okay. And?
One of them says she was treated with Jewish food. The other one says she was given free.
Correct.
Two
ends of the spectrum. They're both, though, presenting the experience of the Jew in exile. Rav is saying that she went out of her way, even though she was not supposed to tell anybody where she was from. Nonetheless, she went out of her way to get herself kosher food. That's the meaning of Jewish food. Whereas the other one says, when they realized she was Jewish, they, Davka, didn't give her kosher food. They specifically avoided giving her kosher food. Either one is an accurate read of the Jewish experience in exile. What the sages are reading here in this layer of the book, and we'll see it at length elsewhere, is they're seeing this as a book that the Jew in exile can look at as a model for their existence. Oh, look, it happened here too. there's more, and here's how they dealt with it. There's more to be said. I've been rushing a little bit because I saw it was 2:30 coming, but I think what we'll do is this. Next time, God willing, we're going to come back to discuss the themes of the book, very briefly, who wrote the book, and then we're going to go into the text itself and start on chapter 1. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about Esther. I want to learn Esther. But the key things to come away with from today are, number one, why we learn Esther. The idea that this is a book, not just with lessons, although it's true, and not just with eternal relevance, as we saw in the stories that we talked about, but just the love of the nation for it. They embraced it. And it's never going to leave the Jewish people, and I want to know why. What is that embrace coming from? Number two, we have our introduction to these expansionist, upstart Persians, and we're going to see them, obviously, through the book. Ahasuerus being Xerxes, it seems most likely. And the Jews themselves as an exile nation, surviving in exile, that's the point of the book, is what is the Jewish experience in exile. There's much more about it. There are more themes that we're going to draw out. But that is, I think, a principal point within this book. So I look forward to continuing next week. As I said in the beginning, I'm going to send out an email just asking for feedback and thoughts on the format, what you want to see in the book of Esther. I look forward to a year of Esther and then, God willing, Ruth and then Echa. God willing, we'll be learning Echa already in retrospect. It won't be a reality for us by then. You know what? You gotta dream big. Thank you very much.